This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
And this week we are on episode 57, where we are going to be covering Medgar Evers.
Yes. And Medgar Evers was a World War II veteran and civil rights leader, becoming the first field secretary for the NAACP in Mississippi. He was gunned down outside of his home by a white supremacist in 1963, and it took 30 years and three trials to bring the man who killed him to justice.
Yeah, it's a nice history piece and true crime piece all combined into one.
Exactly.
Our and fave type.
We feel like we haven't really done any like civil rights people that have been killed for the cause.
Yeah.
And so we felt it was important to start portraying that in our show.
Yeah, for sure. Before we get into our episode, though, what are you binging this week, Sarah?
So this week I'm binging a podcast. It's called Supernatural with Ashley Flowers.
Nice.
And she's the girl who also does Crime Junkie. And she just started this podcast just a couple months ago. There's only 15 episodes out right now. Mm-hmm. But it's on the Parcast Network. And she basically covers anything like conspiracy theories, aliens, like disappearances, like the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah.
Like just anything unexplained, essentially. But it's really good, and it has her same great storytelling as Crime Junkie.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. Like, she's done some of the same things that I've heard before, like the Somerton Man. But it's interesting because she puts it from a different perspective, as from like the mystery aspect as opposed to the true crime aspect.
Right. Yeah. It's fun to tell it from that perspective as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like it. I only listened to like the first couple of episodes and haven't listened to it since. But I also just haven't been listening to podcasts in general. So it's not the podcast's fault.
Yeah. For some reason, all of Ashley Flowers' podcasts that she puts out, like, I listen to them as soon as they come out. And I just really love her storytelling.
Yeah. No, she is a really good storyteller. She has, like, a nice cadence to her voice.
She does. What are you binging this week, Morgan?
I am binging more D&D stuff.
Hell yeah.
I found a new D&D group that I like to watch, and it's called Dimension 20. Okay. And it's it was originally part of College Humor.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they recently like were let go by College Humor or something. I don't really fully know because I've been in the fandom for like a week, so I don't know. They do a lot of different types of games and stuff, but they have one called Fantasy High, which is like my real binge because it is like you take all the stuff of D&D, but it puts them all in high school. So they're like dealing with magic, but also dealing with like puberty and having crushes on people and stuff like that. And it's just like all around very silly because they're all improv actors from College Humor, like playing a role playing game together. So it's very funny, very humorous. I'm already on sophomore year.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But there's like the episodes are a lot shorter than Critical Role. So an episode is only like an hour and 20 minutes usually on average, as opposed to 4.5 hours like Critical Role. So they're a lot easier to get through.
And what was the name of it again?
It's called Fantasy High, but it's by Dimension 20 is like the group's name. And then the show they do is Fantasy High.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's super fun, super silly. And if you don't like D&D, it's like set in a modern setting as well. So it's fun. They have crystals like cell phones. It's very silly.
That's cute. Yeah. And I mean, like, I feel like the people that don't like D&D haven't given it a chance because I never played it before your birthday.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, wow, this is amazing.
It's really fun because it's like you basically are just creating your own story and own game with like having someone kind of just tell you where to go.
Yeah. And it's like, it's just like improv. It's great.
It is. It's fun. It's a fantastic time. Gets you out of your shell. You never thought you could do an accent before. You could do a little accent for your character. It's a great time. Great time. But enough about me nerding out about D&D again. Just makes a second D&D podcast where I just talk about how much I like D&D. There's nothing about how to play, just how much I like it.
I bet you could do it.
I could absolutely do it. It's a matter of no one would listen because it would just be the deranged ramblings of me. But should we get into today's episode?
I think we should do it.
All right. Medgar Wiley Evers was born July 2nd, 1925, in Decatur, Mississippi. His parents were devout Christians, and their names were Jesse and James Evers. And he was the third child born out of five.
I love how his parents are Jesse and James.
Yeah, that is cute. The Evers family owned a small farm, and James also worked at a sawmill. He attended underfunded segregated schools growing up in Mississippi, which the children had to walk 12 miles to in order to attend. Which is like, you know how your parents are like, I walked 12
hills, a mile.
Yeah. 12 miles up a hill both ways and like all of that.
Snow.
And he actually did. Yeah. So. Evers was drafted into the U.S. Army in 1943, where he served during World War II in both France and Germany, even fighting in the Battle of Normandy in June of 1944. At the end of the war in 1945, he was honorably discharged as a sergeant. Upon returning home, Medgar and five of his friends were turned away at gunpoint when trying to vote in a local election for the color of their skin, which makes you like so frustrated because he just fought for his country and then can't even vote.
Yeah.
Like, what's the point in even fighting for your country if you can't vote? In 1948, Medgar enrolled at Alcorn Agriculture and Mechanical College, now Alcorn State University, which is a historically black college. Here, he majored in business administration and did a ton of extracurricular activities. He competed on the college's football and track teams, as well as participating in the debate team, singing in the choir, and was a junior class president.
So from like being in the army to doing all these things, he's a well-rounded person.
Oh, yeah. On December 24th, 1951, he married his classmate, Merle Beasley. Medgar and Merle went on to have three children: Daryl Kenyatta, Rena Denise, and James Van Dyke Evers. The next year, Medgar completed his schoolwork and graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in 1952. After graduating, the couple moved to Mound Bayou, Mississippi, where Medgar was hired as an insurance salesman by T.R.M. Howard, who owned Magnolia Mutual Life Insurance Company. T.R.M. Howard was also the president of the Regional Council of Negro Leadership, RCNL, which was a civil rights and pro-self-help organization, and he became a mentor to Medgar, as well as several other civil rights activists. This is when Medgar started to become heavily involved in civil rights activism, and he helped organize the RCNL's boycott of gas and service stations that denied black people use of their restrooms. The boycotters distributed bumper stickers with the slogan, "Don't buy gas where you can't use the restroom."
Makes sense.
Fair point. Medgar and his brother, Charles Evers, who is also a famous civil rights activist, would attend the RCNL's annual conferences in Mound Bayou between 1952 and 1954. And these conferences would draw a crowd of around 10,000 people or more, which is crazy.
Yeah. So in February of 1954, Medgar quit his job as an insurance salesman to apply for the University of Mississippi Law School. His application was denied because of his race, and he became of interest to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, also known as the NAACP, after submitting his application to be part of their test case for desegregating schools. In May 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court in Brown versus the Board of Education ruled that the segregation of public schools was unconstitutional. This did, however, take many years for all schools to implement.
Yeah.
Later that year, in December, Medgar was named the NAACP's first field secretary for Mississippi, and then they moved him and his family to Jackson, Mississippi. In this position, he would do a number of things, but some included recruiting members throughout Mississippi, setting up new local chapters of the NAACP, organizing voter registration efforts, demonstrations, and economic boycotts of white-owned businesses. He also helped to investigate crimes, like the lynching of Emmett Till, who was a 14-year-old African-American boy who had been killed for allegedly talking to a white woman, as well as protesting the conviction of fellow rights activist Clyde Kennard on theft charges in 1960. He was also instrumental in eventually desegregating the University of Mississippi when James Meredith was finally enrolled in 1962.
There's something really satisfying about him getting, like, denied entry into the other Mississippi state and then, like, this one getting into it.
Yeah.
And, like, helping someone get into it.
Medgar also encouraged Dr. Gilbert Mason Sr. in his organization of the Biloxi Wait-Ins, and these were protests from 1959 to 1963 against the segregation of the city's public beaches on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. He also helped to conduct actions to help integrate Jackson's privately owned buses and Jackson's public parks, as well as Leak County schools and the Mississippi State Fair.
Yeah. And with all of that great work that Medgar was doing, it also made him a prominent black leader in the state of Mississippi, which in turn made him the target of many threats from white supremacists and the KKK. Following the decision of Brown versus the Board of Education, local white people founded the White Citizens Council in Mississippi and started local chapters across the state in order to resist the integration of Mississippi schools and facilities.
It's crazy to think that, like, I know that it's, like, only 40 years ago, people yeah. were trying to keep black people and white people in different schools. And, like, it's crazy to think that that was only, like, when my parents were in their teenagers.
My dad was in middle school when his school got desegregated in yeah. Sarasota. Like, the fuck?
It's crazy.
Like, that's insane. That shouldn't be. It shouldn't have been that recent.
Right?
And it's also, like, very easy to forget that it's that recent if you're not a black person, because it doesn't affect you in the same way. So you just, like, don't think about it.
Exactly.
Yeah. His first work with the NAACP on a national level involved interviewing Mississippians who had been intimidated by the White Citizens Council and preparing affidavits for use as evidence against the councils if necessary. And this made him a prime target of threats by the White Citizens Council. I don't know why this is going to be the weirdest thing I ever say, but something about the NAACP, like, saying it mm-hmm. has always been so satisfying to me. Like,
right?
Even since I was, like, in middle school and, like, had read about it in history books, I always just loved saying
the
NAACP. Like, I don't know why.
It rolls nicely off the tongue.
Yeah, it's just, like, a very nice, like, acronym for a organization.
Yeah, because, like, the other one was, like, the RCNL, like,
yeah, and you feel like you're gonna get letters. Yeah. confused, but, like, the NAACP, girl, you're never gonna get the letters confused,
right?
Jesus Christ. Sorry, guys. Okay. So Medgar would frequently have the protection of two FBI cars and a police car that would follow him around and make sure that he would get home safely after attending NAACP events. And he and his wife even went so far as to train their three children on what to do in the case of a bombing, shooting, or any other attacks on their lives.
Like, that is so sad to have to teach your three young children, like, this is what you do if you hear gunshots in the house or whatever.
Yeah, it is very sad. And being accustomed to threats, Medgar understood that he may die as a martyr. At one point, he said, "I'm not afraid of dying. It might do some good." And that if he ever died, it would be for a worthy cause, saying, "I've been fighting for America just as much as the soldiers in Vietnam." On May 28th, 1963, a Molotov cocktail was thrown into the carport of his home. Civil rights demonstrations increased in Jackson during the first week of June 1963, and a local television station granted Medgar on-air time for a short speech, which was his first television appearance, and this is where he outlined the goals of the Jackson movement. After this appearance, the death threats toward Medgar increased. On June 7th, 1963, he was almost run over by a car when exiting the Jackson NAACP office.
So things were getting serious.
Yeah, attacks were happening more frequently and like the threats were becoming actual threats instead of just verbal.
So on June 11th, 1963, President John F. Kennedy gave his nationally televised civil rights address in support of civil rights. Just hours later, at 12:40 a.m., Medgar was returning home after an integration meeting with the NAACP lawyers. When driving home, he was not followed by any FBI or police cars for protection, and the FBI and police were not able to give any reason on why they weren't giving him his usual protection.
Yeah.
And some people speculate that many members of the police force were also members of the KKK.
Which,
so they're all kind of in on it.
Yeah. If you haven't listened to our minisode, apparently the KKK members were out and proud and just living their lives.
Upon leaving for the meeting that day, Medgar's family worried for his life. And he had even told his wife that he felt as though he was in greater danger than usual. Medgar's family had been waiting for him to come home. And when he pulled into the driveway, his children excitedly ran to tell their mother that he was home.
Yeah.
After exiting his car, Medgar was carrying NAACP t-shirts that said, "Jim Crow must go," and walking up the driveway towards his front door. This is when he was struck in the back with a bullet fired from an Enfield 197 rifle. The bullet passed through his heart and ricocheted into the kitchen of his home. He was knocked to the ground at first from the impact of the shot, but he managed to get back up and staggered another 30 feet before collapsing at his front door. Imagine getting shot in the heart.
Like, yeah.
And it went through and into his house. Luckily, no one else was hurt.
Yeah.
But, like, wow. His wife, Merle, was the first to find him and rushed him to the hospital. And this hospital initially refused to take in Medgar because of his race. But after Merle explained to the hospital who he was, they admitted him. He ended up dying 50 minutes after being admitted into the hospital. But he was the first African-American to be admitted to an all-white hospital in Mississippi. And he was 37 years old when he died.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. His son Daryl said, recalling the night, "We were ready to greet him because every time he came home, it was special for us. He was traveling a lot at that time. All of a sudden, we heard a shot. We knew what it was." After hearing the shot, the children ran to the bathroom and hid in the bathtub as part of the training that Medgar had instilled in his children.
Sad.
It is. This is a, it's tough.
Yeah. Every case we cover, like, is sad, but I have no language to say anything else, I guess, once I'm, like, actually at the, like, mic to record.
Right.
After his death, Medgar was mourned nationally. He was buried on June 19th, 1963, in Arlington National Cemetery, where he received full military honors. More than 3,000 people attended the funeral. At the service, Mickey Levine, the past chairman of the American Veterans Committee, said, "No soldier in this field has fought more courageously, more heroically than Medgar Evers." The NAACP also posthumously awarded Medgar with their 1963 Spingarn Medal, which is an award given annually for outstanding achievement by an African American. Immediately after his death, the NAACP appointed Medgar's brother, Charles, to the position. Charles later went on to become a major political figure in the state, and in 1969, he was elected as the mayor of Fayette, Mississippi, becoming the first African-American mayor of a racial mixed town since the Reconstruction after the Civil War. After Medgar's assassination, around 5,000 people marched from the Masonic Temple on Lynch Street to the Collins Funeral Home on North Ferris Street in Jackson. Allen Johnson, Martin Luther King Jr., and other civil rights leaders led the procession. The Mississippi State Police came to the protest in riot gear and with rifles in case the protest turned violent. Time magazine posted their obituary for Medgar in 1963 and wrote about the violence that ensued during the protests. And I'm going to read the following quote and just know that I am using the language of the time. "Among Mississippi Negroes, the anger over Evers' murder coiled like a snake. 13 ministers began a silent walk, one by one, at widely spaced intervals toward City Hall. To Jackson's cops, this was just another protest march, and up came the paddy wagons to haul the marchers off. Next day, the cops rushed a group standing on a porch, clubbed some Negroes, grabbed a white man, throttled him with a billy club, kicked and beat him till blood gushed from his wounds. A day later, Negro youngsters again moved down the street in ones and twos, carrying tiny American flags. It was Flag Day. They, too, were blocked by police, relieved of their flags, and carrying off to a hog wire compound."
The police and FBI, who were investigating the murder, quickly came upon a prime suspect, Byron De La Beckwith.
Also, this guy's full last name is technically De La Beckwith. He gets the De La dropped. We're not saying it every time.
Oh, no. So, the evidence against Beckwith included a rifle found near the crime scene that was registered to Beckwith, containing his fingerprints on the scope, as well as several witnesses placing him in the area. The FBI was able to find his fingerprints by comparing it to his military service prints. Witnesses also said that Beckwith had been asking around, trying to figure out where Medgar lived prior to the shooting.
Definitely a way to keep yourself low-key and not draw any suspicion towards yourself, Beckwith.
Don't be suspicious.
Don't be suspicious.
The reason why the gun was left at the scene, and I think this is kind of funny, is because when he fired the shot, he jumped up in pain as the scope of the gun hit him in the eye, bruising him badly, so he just dropped the gun and ran off.
Like, he got literally... What a little bitch.
Right.
Like, you just shot someone and you hurt your eye. So you're like, man, leave your gun behind.
Like, which is like the one thing that actually really got him.
Yeah. You know? Like, that was the main piece of evidence.
Yeah. Of course, Beckwith denied shooting Medgar, saying that his gun had been stolen. Oldest story in the book. How many times have we fucking heard my gun was stolen?
Or just like anything was stolen.
Yeah.
It wasn't stolen. You would have reported it stolen.
Like that lady from Miami, like the last minisode, she said her car was stolen when she drowned her kid.
Yeah. Well, my sister-in-law, when she got in that really bad car accident, they tracked the car down, and the person was like, oh, our car got stolen, but they brought it back. And they were like, that's just not true.
That's not
that
what
didn't happen at all.
Beckwith also produced witnesses that said he was elsewhere on the night of the shooting. And just a little bit of background on Beckwith. He was born on November 9th, 1920, in Colusa, California. His father died of pneumonia when he was 5, and he and his mother moved to Greenwood, Mississippi to be closer to family. His mother died of lung cancer when he was 12, which left him orphaned, and he was raised by his maternal uncle and his wife. He enlisted as a member of the Marine Corps in 1942 and served as a machine gunner in World War II. So they both fought for World War II.
Yeah.
During a battle, he was shot in the waist and honorably discharged from the Marines in 1945. After being discharged, he married twice and had a son. Beckwith worked as a salesman after getting out of the Marines, selling tobacco, wood stoves, fertilizer, and other goods. And as he became an adult, was a member, in some places I read that he was a founding member, but I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
But he was at least a member of the White Citizens Council and later became a member of the KKK.
It was really hard to tell. I think he might have been like a founding member of his local chapter or something, like something weirdly specific like that. Like he was a founding member somewhere. Despite Beckwith's denial of any involvement with the crime, the police had enough evidence to arrest him with the death of Medgar Evers on June 21st, 1963. Trials were held in February and April of 1964 for this case. Bill Waller was the district attorney who prosecuted Beckwith and would later become the governor. The White Citizens Council paid Beckwith's legal expenses in both trials, which would eventually end in a hung jury. And these juries this is obviously going to make total sense, but these juries were made up of all white male jurors.
Yep.
This was because Mississippi had disenfranchised black voters since 1890. So they were essentially excluded from serving on juries because a pool of jurors were drawn from their voting polls and they weren't allowed to vote. So effectively, you weren't allowed to serve on a jury if you were anything other than white. One of the questions the district attorney asked to every single juror was if they thought it was a crime to kill a N-word in Mississippi. What a graphic thing to say.
Right? Like that is...
I know that, that was the language of the time, but it's just such a harsh word. Like, I feel like it shouldn't have ever been anyone's language.
I know. Well, but even that question is, no, it's not okay for anyone to kill anyone.
Yeah. So, here's a real big oh no fact. And this is probably my least favorite fact because it just pissed me off so much.
It is infuriating.
So, during the second trial, the governor of Mississippi at the time of the assassination, Ross Barnett, interrupted the proceedings of said trial to shake hands with Beckwith, the murderer, while Medgar Evers' widow was testifying.
How fucking sad.
Like, how fucking disrespectful and how much of a power trip do you have to be on to do something like that?
Yeah, I'm the governor of this state, and I'm going to shake your hand because you killed a black person.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do it in front of his wife. While she's talking about finding her dead husband.
Yeah. I am a great politician. what the fuck is wrong with you, dude?
Right.
After the second trial was over and the state of Mississippi seemed to no longer want to pursue justice in this case, Merle Evers told a New York Times reporter that she promised herself I'm going to make whoever did this pay. Later in January 1966, Beckwith and other members of the White Knights of the KKK were subpoenaed by the House Un-American Activities Committee to testify about their Klan activities. And I looked this up, and this was like a real house, like a real committee within the government. Like,
wow.
They just were like called up by the government basically and were like, hey, what are you doing over there with your Klan activities? And supposedly during this like whole testifying thing, Beckwith gave his name when asked by the committee, but every other person who was there invoked the Fifth Amendment in response to the questions and wouldn't even give their name.
Yeah, like I guess Beckwith only gave his name and didn't answer the rest of the questions, but yeah. Everyone else was like,
we're not answering a single question, yeah. Not even my name. In the years preceding these trials, Beckwith is obviously a terrible person and continued to do a series of shitty things that we won't go too in-depth about, but some in which include that he got convicted of conspiracy to commit murder against the director of the B'nai B'rith Anti-Defamation League. And that person's name was A.I. Botnick. And he was arrested with several firearms, a map with highlighted directions to Botnick's house, and a dynamite time bomb, like, on the way to this person's house. And he did serve 3 years in prison from this, from 1977 to 1980. But he was, like, doing essentially hate crimes in the 30 years between him doing the first murder and, like, getting put in jail for it.
Yeah. So after the second trial, Merle Evers moved with her children to California, where she earned a degree from Pomona College. She would later be named the Los Angeles Commission of Public Works. And the whole time she did these things, she refused to abandon her husband's case and continued to look for new evidence. A Washington Post article stated that Merle had engulfed herself in civil rights work, quote, more than any of the other civil rights widows. And by doing this, she was showing America her rage.
She's like Eliza from the musical Hamilton.
Right? Like, Merle is an inspiration.
Yeah.
In 1989, the Jackson Clarion Ledger raised guilt about Beckwith again, when they published accounts of the files of the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission. The organization is now defunct, but when it existed, it helped raise popular support for the maintenance of segregation. The accounts showed that jurors in the previous case were screened by the commission. The DA did an investigation into this and found no evidence of jury tampering, but they did locate a number of new witnesses, including several who would later testify about Beckwith bragging about the murder. And they wanted to testify now because they felt more safe in doing so than they did in the 60s. Jerry Mitchell, a Jackson newspaper reporter, helped Merle in obtaining new evidence. He questioned police officers that originally gave Beckwith his alibi, but now they were mixing up their stories, and he also helped to locate the new witnesses.
Yeah, that's cool that she got, like, help from someone.
Mm-hmm. The culmination of all of this new evidence initiated a third prosecution. When Merle wanted this new prosecution to go to trial, Mississippi prosecutor Bobby DeLofter explained to her that the state wouldn't be able to find new evidence against the decades-old case to be able to convict Beckwith. And instead of, like, acting angry, Merle just calmly asked Bobby and his team, just try.
Yeah, it's already failed twice for her. Like, just do it again. What's it gonna try?
By this time, Beckwith was 71 years old and living in Signal Mountain, Tennessee. In December 1990, he was indicted for the murder of Medgar Evers, having lived about 3 decades after this murder as a free man. After a number of appeals, In April of 1993, the Mississippi Supreme Court finally ruled in favor of a third trial. He was extradited to Mississippi for trial at the Hinds County Courthouse in Jackson. Before his trial, he asked the justices to dismiss the case against him, saying it violated his right to speedy trial, due process, and protection from double jeopardy. But the Mississippi court ruled against this with a 4-3 vote, and the case was scheduled to go to trial for in January of 1994.
Real close to not getting that vote, but still got it. The new trial was held before a jury of 8 black people and 4 white people. During the third trial, the murder weapon, an Enfield 197 caliber rifle with Beckwith's fingerprints, was presented.
And apparently I heard that like the rifle was lost in evidence for a while, so they didn't even know if they were going to have it until like the last minute.
Super fun, yeah. Super responsible. He claimed that the gun again had been stolen from his house and was used. And he also listed off a series of health problems like high blood pressure, lack of energy, and kidney problems. And he said, "I need a list to recite everything I suffer from. And I hate to complain because I'm not the complaining type."
Bitch, shut the fuck up.
Sounds like you're the complaining type, motherfucker. You're complaining about having high blood pressure when you murdered a man in his fucking mid-30s or like 30 years ago. So go fuck yourself.
Yeah, you're complaining because you might go to jail when you had 30 years free when you killed this man 30 years ago and his whole family doesn't have him.
Yeah, and he didn't get to live his life free. Beckwith also came to court every day of this trial wearing a Confederate pin just to really drive home the point that I haven't changed, I guess. I'm not sure. Medgar's body was exhumed during this trial for an additional autopsy, and due to the proper embalming practice, his body was actually in pretty good shape. New evidence in the trial included testimony from Delmer Dennis that he had boasted about the murder at a Klan rally and that he had continued to boast about it in the 3 decades following the murder. Other than that, the physical evidence was pretty much the same as what was presented at the first trial. Finally, though, after 31 years, he was convicted of first-degree murder for killing Medgar Evers. After the guilty verdict was read, Merle cried, and afterwards, according to the Los Angeles Times, she jumped for joy, looked up to the sky, and said, "Medgar, I've gone the last mile of the way," which is just very sweet.
It is.
He would go on to appeal his guilty verdict, Beckwith would, but the Mississippi Supreme Court upheld his conviction in 1997. They said the 31-year-old lapse between the murder and his conviction did not deny him a fair trial.
Yeah.
He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Thank God, some justice.
Yeah. He sought judicial review again from the United States Supreme Court, but it was denied. On January 21st, 2001... Beckwith died after he was transferred from prison to the University of Mississippi Medical Center in Jackson, Mississippi. He was 80 years old when he died and had suffered from heart disease, high blood pressure, and other ailments for quite a while and basically just died of old age.
Yeah. So, less about the shitty murderer Beckwith.
Yeah.
And more about Medgar's legacy. Before his body was reburied, because of its good condition, a new funeral was staged for Medgar. And this allowed his children, who were very young at the time of his death, like some of them were even toddlers, to have a chance to see him and say their final goodbyes. And this funeral was actually covered on HBO's Autopsy series.
Which I didn't even know existed, but after doing research and finding that out, I was like, I'm interested.
Right?
This sounds very cool.
The 1996 film, Ghosts of Mississippi, tells the story of the 1994 trial and getting justice. On June 28th, 1992, the city of Jackson, Mississippi erected a statue in honor of Medgar, which is still standing today. All of Delta Drive in Jackson was renamed in Medgar's honor. In 2004, the Jackson City Council renamed the city's airport to the Jackson Medgar Wiley Evers International Airport.
That's cool.
Yeah. He was identified as a freedom hero by the My Hero Project. And in 2009, the Navy named a cargo ship after him, the USNS Medgar Evers, which his wife actually ended up being able to christen in 2011. In 2017, President Obama designated the Evers home a National Historic Landmark. After he did this, Mississippi Senator Thad Cochran said, "The National Historic Landmark designation is an important step towards recognizing and preserving significant civil rights sites in Mississippi and around the country. The sacrifices made by Medgar and Merle Evers deserve this distinction." And 2 years later, in 2019, it was established as a national monument as opposed to a national landmark, being named the Medgar and Merle Evers Home National Monument, which today, well, I don't know about today with the coronavirus,
yeah,
but it can be toured by appointment. The house was refurbished in the 1990s and is filled with mid-century furniture. One of the building bedrooms has a display about the family's history, and a bullet hole can be seen in the kitchen where the bullet ricocheted into the house. So that hole's still there.
Interesting. Merle Ever Williams is now remarried and became a noted activist in her own right. In 1995, she was elected chairwoman of the board of directors of the NAACP, and she would be the third woman to do so. She also created the Medgar and Merle Evers Institute in Jackson, and this institute pushes for social change, exchanges across generational lines, and social and economic justice. She also delivered the invocation at Barack Obama's second inauguration, and this made her the first woman and first layperson to deliver the invocation at the presidential inauguration, which is super cool. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we wrote it, but she is still alive today, and she's 87 years old and still doing her thing.
Yeah, she's like still doing stuff to this day, still out and about being an activist. Unfortunately, in 2001, their son Daryl Evers died of colon cancer. But they do have two remaining children, Rena Denise and James Van Dyke. In 2012, Rena became the executive director of the Jackson-based Medgar and Merle Evers Institute. And she also moved back to Jackson, Mississippi, saying that she felt called to be there after previously telling herself that she would never move back to Jackson for the rest of her life, which is kind of nice.
Yeah.
And James Van Dyke has decided that he wants to make his own way through life and does not announce who his parents are to people. He is a successful commercial photographer who does portraits, editorial work, and still photography on television shows. Others have chastised him for not going the activism route, but he says it isn't his calling, it was his father's, which is the same thing, like, just because your father plays football doesn't mean you have to play football. Like,
exactly.
That's not how that works.
Yeah, if it's not what you want to do and what you're not passionate about, you're probably not going to do a good job at doing it.
Yeah, and he's doing a great job at being a photographer. And something also very cool is that as a photographer, James was able to capture the moment that the first Black president of the United States was shaking hands with the grandchildren of Medgar Evers, which is just really freaking nice. And he like got to take pictures of his mom giving the invocation. Like, it was a family moment for them all to be at that inauguration, which is really nice.
Yeah.
On the 40th anniversary of his death, hundreds of civil rights veterans, government officials, and students from across from across the country gathered around his gravesite to celebrate his life and legacy. One more sentence, Morgan. Come on. Your throat's dry. On the 50th anniversary, Medgar was honored in a tribute at Arlington National Cemetery. Former President Bill Clinton, Attorney General Eric Holder, Navy Secretary Ray Mabus, Senator Roger Wicker, NAACP President Benjamin Jealous, and his wife Merle all spoke at the event commemorating Medgar. His wife said, "Medgar was a man who never wanted adoration, who never wanted to be in the limelight. He was a man who saw a job that needed to be done, and he answered the call in the fight for freedom, dignity, and justice. Not just for his people, but all people." Which is like a nice quote to end on, I think.
It really is. And that's the story of Medgar Evers.
Yeah.
And, like, growing up learning about civil rights, you learn about Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks, but I've never heard about this guy. And
yeah.
He was a prominent figure, and his wife and his brother.
Yeah, and doing this research, like, this is a guy that we absolutely should have known. So, yeah, I think it's important to know your history. And unfortunately, a lot of history is also true crime.
It is. Yeah.
You know? And we got to know about it.
Yeah. And so we're definitely going to try and put, like, different civil rights things or even different historical things into our regular episodes.
Yeah. We're just going to represent people of color more in our yes. episodes. It doesn't have to be civil rights.
Yeah.
We just want
to. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, we want to represent more people of color because we're white people and it's easy to cover other white people, but crime doesn't just happen to white people.
Yeah.
But do you want to give us a Florida man?
I sure do.
All right.
So this Florida man story comes to us out of Miami. And the title of the article is, I'm already laughing.
I can tell.
Florida, fuck.
You got to get through it without laughing or,
I know.
Or we can't do it. Just cut the Florida man. I'm just kidding.
Florida man poops in court, flings feces at judge, and then it gets real weird. That's just the title.
The title is, and then it gets real weird.
It's not like a newspaper.
Okay. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
The Miami Herald be doing the most with those article titles.
It's from news965.com.
Nice.
So.
It'd be funnier if it was news69.com.
Ayo.
Sorry. Just tell your Florida man. I'll leave you alone. I'm sorry.
So. Court officials say a Florida man defecated during his criminal trial and tried to throw the feces at the judge. But that's not all. The Miami Herald reports 33-year-old DeLorenz Fildor was in Miami-Dade Circuit Court on Friday on charges of burglary and grand theft. And this is from a little bit ago. He was sitting in a wheelchair next to Judge Lisa Walsh, when officials say he tried to throw his excrement at her before closing arguments began. Like, I get if it's after sentencing, but come on. Luckily, it missed, and there were no jurors present either.
Yeah.
Philidor yelled at the judge, "It's protein. It's good for you."
That's foul.
And then he started to eat some of the feces.
Sarah! Why are you telling me this story?
Okay.
I hate it.
That's the only part about eating feces.
That's the only part about eating feces.
So, it's almost done, I promise. According to the Miami Herald, dozens of correction officers responded, and the trial was moved while the courtroom was sanitized. A spokeswoman told the paper that Philidor also defecated on himself in a holding cell on Thursday. So it's like, does he have just, like, issues where he can't hold it or what? And later, a jury actually acquitted him of the burglary charge, but he still faces another trial for the grand theft auto.
Does he face a charge for the shit?
It literally says no word yet if he'll face any charges involving the feces.
I feel like that's fucking biological warfare to throw your fucking shit at someone.
I don't know why. I thought it was so fucking fun. Just like,
it's
just
like,
imagine a serious setting.
Yeah.
And you're not, like, he didn't outbreak beforehand.
Like, yeah, you know, like it just happened randomly.
Fucking happened.
Jesus Christ. This is what Florida's like, I guess.
Right?
I don't know. Yeah, that's upsetting to say the least.
Morgan isn't a big fan of like excrement jokes, I would say.
Like, I think farts and poop jokes are like funny, but saying it's protein and then trying to eat it is like that one step, you know, just right over the line. Like, we're dabbling with our toes on the line, and that's where it goes over. You guys continue to stay safe out there. Protests are still happening pretty much like every day across the country.
Yeah, so far I think they said it's been 20 straight days of protests.
So be careful if you are attending, if you are not attending, if you're able to help. If not able to help, read a fucking book.
Yeah, just learn about the
read
cause.
The internet. Something.
Do something to better yourself on this cause.
Read something that isn't just a purely biased news station. When you find one, let me know. But we hope that you guys enjoyed this week's episode.
Please check us out on social media. We're on the Twitters, the Instagrams, and the Facebooks.
We're really the best at Instagram.
Yes.
But you can check us out at those other places.
Right? And we're at Crime Binge or Crime Binge Podcast anywhere. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Yeah.
We have gotten a couple new ones lately, and they were so sweet.
Yeah.
And made us so happy. So please, it takes like 5 seconds to
do. And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.